Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the TLS. My name is Thea Lenarduzzi and I am joined this week by the TLS's green-fingered arts editor, Lucy Dallas. Lucy, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I say green-fingered because last time we were here together we launched a half-baked, extremely sporadic, I think this is only the second instalment, feature in which you showcase your vegetal prowess. So, Lucy Dallas, what's growing in your allotment at the moment?
Well, first of all, I'm not happy with the idea of showcasing my vegetal prowess. I'm really not sure about that one. Very little, Thea, because it's April.
It is, yeah.
But I'm about to start defending my soft fruits. That's not a euphemism.
Seems fitting for our Avengers special this week. The whole sidelining.
Exactly. No, because the gooseberries and the red currants are going to come up. And last year, there were like millions of them on
and
the
you
bushes.
Were not prepared.
I was not prepared and I got not a single one. I mean, not one, because
it's
the wildlife, which I had been admiring in a kind of look at the lovely birds and squirrels way, was really way ahead of me on that one. So this time I'm going to show them who's boss, which is almost certainly them, but I'm going to make an attempt.
Try to temper their bossness.
I'm going to net it and make things a little bit more difficult for them.
Well, I think we'll all agree that we're looking forward to the next instalment in this mini-series. Before I tell you what we have coming up on this week's show, I'm pleased to announce a special subscription offer for podcast listeners only. For just £5 or $5, you can have 6 weeks of the TLS's Complete Works membership. Lucy, could you explain what that is?
I can. You get the TLS, you get the paper delivered to your door every Thursday. Every Thursday, let's be honest, if you're very lucky.
Yeah, for everything. All the stars align.
Yeah. Full access to the TLS website and the app, so all the stuff that you can't get anywhere else. And the archive that has over a century of our articles with Virginia Woolf, Roland Barthes. Has it got Roland Barthes?
It has.
I thought it did. I wasn't sure. And Martin Amis, all those wonderful people.
Well, so if you live in the USA or Canada, go to, and I think Stig might have got this wrong last week because let's face it, it's a torrent of URL nonsense. podcast.the-tls.com. If you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. That's POD19. Whew. And so, this week on the show, we have a special focus in this week's issue of the TLS on superheroes, comics and graphic novels. I will be almost completely out of my depth, but fear not, Roz Caveney will be bringing her vastly superior knowledge to bear. In the latest roundup of the best children's and YA literature, Imogen Russell Williams has considered books with LGBTQ themes, covering myriad identities and myriad paths to adulthood, from little boys who transform into glittering mermaids to a book of cheerful, filthy advice for those in the clammy grasp of puberty.
Unless you live in a cave on a mountain without TV, radio or Wi-Fi, in which case, well done for listening to this, you've probably heard about the new Avengers film, part of a phase which comprises 22 films from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You may be a superfan or it might leave you cold, but it is breaking all sorts of records and it's difficult to avoid. We will be discussing it today, with no spoilers, don't worry, with Roz Caveney, who has written about the story cycle for us in this week's paper. Roz, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Can we start with, I'm afraid, quite a big and rather difficult question. Why superheroes? Why do you think we want protagonists with capes and powers at the moment rather than cowboys or detectives or Bruce Willis in a vest? I mean, maybe we want that too.
It's a mixture of things. It's partly the sheer bulk of material. Both the DC and Marvel comics companies have built a complex universe of story that's one of the biggest narrative artefacts, certainly in Western culture. Partly because it's about superheroes, but partly because it's about a lot of other characters as well. I mean, most of their superheroes have civilian identities, and a lot of the time the comics are about those civilian lives. So it's not just the capes and the powers, it's the people. It's the way that, as a collective enterprise, because obviously every superhero has been written by a vast number of hands and drawn by a vast number of artists over the, in the case of DC, 80 years, in the case of Marvel, 60 plus years, with the result that they've developed complexity. I mean, there's nothing that consistent in the universe of cowboy films, is the answer, I think. It's the layered richness that superhero narratives have acquired completely by chance. If, as happens in Alan Moore's Watchmen, the obsession had been with comics about pirates, then we'd be obsessed with pirates.
Yes.
But yeah, that's not what happened. We got obsessed from the 1930s onwards with caped superheroes. They filled a need. Grant Morrison, in a book, suggests that they are gods and saints for a secular world.
Mm.
And that's obviously part of the story too.
But, I mean, presumably it also boils down to the sheer size and heft of the companies, DC and Marvel together. And I think presumably this is going to be an outdated statistic, but in 2017 they together owned 70% of that particular kind of corner of the market.
Well,
in any other sector, you'd be talking about monopolies and worrying about the impact that that would have on culture.
Well, yes. But on the other hand, part of what's happened is that sooner or later, every brilliant independent writer in the comics field either makes the decision to work part-time for them or to be pure and poor.
Yeah, I read somewhere that didn't Marvel start trying to do this as an independent kind of operation, and so they ended up franchising off lots of their belongings, but they tried to do it as an independent company and they just couldn't, and so
yeah,
now we're left
right.
with these
monsters. And of course they are owned by Disney, and DC are owned by Warner.
Mm.
They are themselves part of much larger conglomerates.
It's a bit, the only thing, when we were talking about it earlier, Thea, the only thing that I could think about in similar sort of monopoly type situations was the big tech companies. Those are the only things that really approach it. And they're not a million miles away, are they?
And the other thing that's happened is when people have done subversive stuff, the tropes of subversion have got absorbed into, I mean,
yeah. I was about to say, they're very good at spotting talent and bringing it in.
Yeah.
Controlling
it. As you say, paying them a bit more.
And also letting them have their head. I mean, obviously, because we were and are friends, I watched the process whereby Neil Gaiman started off doing little indie comics with Dave McKean, like Violent Cases, which was about his father and about Al Capone's osteopath. And a couple of years later, DC came to London and showed him the kingdoms of the world from a high place, which is how he got to do Sandman, because they trust, the other thing they've done is trust talent.
Mm.
Yes, and they are, which big corporations are not always good at doing.
No.
Sometimes they make safe bets, and actually artistically that turns out to be...
Yeah, I mean, and Marvel and DC have had hundreds of false steps, but also the things we remember tend to be the things that worked. And that's just, hate to say it, capitalism in action.
Yes, yes.
It's one of the things that does get done sometimes. And one of the consequences of that is occasional flirtations with the ultra-right, like the recent Captain America was always a secret Nazi plot that Marvel did for a while, which has a joke about it in the movie.
Mm. What's this subplot? I have no idea.
One of the byways, isn't it?
It was a byway. Yeah. It was an alternate universe. It was all
It's not real. It's okay.
It was a bad idea. We will never speak of it again, yeah. Except there is a joke about it in the movie.
Okay. I've seen the movie. I went to see the movie on Sunday because I just felt I should. Otherwise, I'd be sitting here before you feeling utterly
there is
naked.
What you think is going to be a reprise of a famous scene from Captain America: Winter Soldier.
Right.
And we won't
and
spoil
that's it. Where
and
we'll gets, leave it.
Yeah. And then something happens.
He defuses the situation.
It is brilliant.
By what is actually a joke.
Yeah. And Roz, as you say, it's among the largest bodies of story in Western culture. Do you think it will rank along other story cycles, those of gods and other types of hero?
Well, more people probably know it now.
Mm. I was just thinking about Norse myth and Greek myth and
exactly.
the Ring of the Nibelungen.
Marvel, it's a vast amoeba that absorbs everything. I mean, you know, it's like the way that sooner or later Disney will buy up all of Jane Austen, and then Elizabeth Bennet will be a Disney princess.
Yeah, gosh, I mean, it's impossible. Yeah. It's impossible to conceive of the end of this empire.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's slightly scary, but also slightly wonderful as well.
But also the world of the superheroes, especially the ones that we're seeing on screen. I know the comics is a different timeline, but the world is changing, isn't it, in that now we are seeing a new diversity in the characters. And as you say in your piece, it used to be a bunch of white men, and then Black Panther proved that an almost all black cast and director can be a smash at the box office.
Yeah. I mean, in fairness to both companies, they started doing this as long ago as the 1960s, the 1970s. Stan Lee, who was the co-creator stroke entrepreneur of Marvel, was a man with quite liberal politics, given that he was also slightly in the pocket of the CIA, but that's another story for another time.
Good story for another time.
So, for example, the persecuted mutants of the X-Men were a free-floating signifier for oppressed minorities. And he brought in, slightly time-servingly, blaxploitation superheroes like the Black Panther, like Luke Cage, who's had a very successful television show, at quite an early point in the history of Marvel. But that's become much more of a thing recently.
Yes, because
of
the films.
In the films, but also in the comics. I mean, you have one of the most successful comics of recent years has been Ms. Marvel, who is not to be confused with Captain Marvel,
because
very different.
Ms. Marvel is a young New Jersey Muslim fangirl who acquires superpowers that are not the same as her heroine, whom she stands, as the kids say, but who is trying to balance being a good little Muslim schoolgirl and being a superhero, and it's not played in any parodic way. It's written with real respect, but also real charm. And she has long chats about superpowers with her imam without actually telling him anything.
As I said, I went to see the Avengers film on Sunday, and I went to it very much with this idea that it's almost an impervious world. It's too late for me. So much has happened that I could never even begin to get involved. And I was quite surprised, actually, that the film, it was not for me, but I appreciated it as a thing. But most importantly, most interestingly, I think, was it was perfectly accessible to someone who had not seen 21 films before it.
Mm. Yes.
You can
even
step
though it's
in.
Been described as a fan service film and with all of these asides and nods and stuff, and you mentioned one before, for example, it didn't seem necessary to the enjoyment of the thing.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's partly because all of the because of the layered complexity that multiple collaboration brings to the characters, they're simultaneously archetypes and individuals. And they, we sort of absorb them through the culture.
Mm.
You may not, you may think you don't know who these people are, but you sort of do.
Mm.
But I mean, obviously, that's even truer with the two great DC characters, Superman and Batman, because we all know that Batman is really Bruce Wayne, that he was traumatized by the death of his parents in Crime Alley. We all know that Superman was sent here from Krypton when Krypton exploded. That's just one of those things we all know. We know that as well as we know that, oh, that some Francis talked to birds.
Mm. As you say, it's become a part of the fabric of our web, you know, our tapestry of stories that we share.
Well, I wonder if when we were talking about other myths, I suppose it is a bit like the Greek myths because they're also told by multiple voices.
Yes, exactly.
And have been retold many times. And in the same way, we know that Odysseus met someone with one eye, and you know, even if you haven't read any of it.
Well, it is the thing that happens when stories are told over and over again and constantly rebooted, that they acquire texture.
Mm.
One of the consequences of what I've called the universalization of geek culture is that we've all sort of learned to read popular culture as thick texts and look at, as it were, all the stories that have been told layered on top of each other, all of the alternative stories, all the alternative versions of stories. This is one of the reasons why Into the Spider-Verse, which, you know, the cartoon I talk about in the review, which came out last year, can simply say, oh, this is going to be a Spider-Man film in which we won't talk about Peter Parker, because in the alternate universe that... I think we can spoil Into the Spider-Verse.
I think it's been out long enough. I think we can...
In the alternate universe in which this particular Spider-Man film is dead, Peter Parker gets himself killed, and this younger Afro-Hispanic kid, Miles Morales, who has also been bitten by a radioactive spider, has to take on the mantle. But not only that, he finds himself, because it's about a machine that creates portals between multiple universes, he finds himself fighting alongside a much older version of Peter Parker, a version of Peter Parker from a black and white gangster universe, played by Nicolas Cage, a small cartoon animal.
Yes,
spider
a pig.
A small pig.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Who's referenced in The Simpsons, if I'm not mistaken?
No, that's
the other
Marvel,
way around, I think.
It's the other way around. Marvel stole it from The Simpsons. And also Spider-Gwen. Now, Gwen Stacy is one of the standard characters of the Marvel Universe. She's the first high school girlfriend who very tragically gets killed. Except that there is a version of the Marvel Universe, which has had its own comics, in which it wasn't Peter Parker that got bitten by the spider. It was Gwen. And her, Peter Parker, got himself killed. So rather than him living with the guilt of her death, she lives with the guilt of his death.
It's a lovely device because it solves any questions about who it can be, or kind of sacred notions of who it is, or any questions about diversity or anything else in one go, and then it's just like, okay, well, what happens now?
And as Stan Lee himself says in the persona of a crooked souvenir shop owner, when Miles Morales buys his first costume, he said, sooner or later it fits everybody.
Yeah,
and that's him making a cameo appearance just not long before he died.
Yeah,
because the other two that in the film that had come out subsequently were, I think, shot earlier.
Mm.
But he did record the voiceover for the cartoon.
Right. Mm. To what extent do these works respond to the times in which they are shown? So the Avengers film, for example, what are the politics of that? Or does it steer clear of it?
Well, I'd argue both yes and no, because part of the point of the Marvel Universe is that Stan was an old-fashioned Roosevelt Democrat. The version of Captain America that he brought back from suspended animation is very specifically a Roosevelt anti-fascist Democrat dumped in the 21st century by being awoken from sleep. And so it's partly about values. It's partly about values that don't change and confronting the modern world with them. That's part of the charm. I mean, a lot of people who don't know all this assume that Captain America is a gung-ho fascist. And he's not. If you look at Captain America, the First Avenger, it's very much shot as a World War II film, not just about fighting Germans, but about quite specifically fighting Nazis. Mm. Except it's fighting Hydra, who are like the Nazis' Nazis.
They're like Nazis squared, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like nastier than the Nazis.
The Red Skull.
Yeah.
Also, the movies are quite... I mean, Robert Downey Jr. made us love Tony Stark, but the movies, while loving the super technologist millionaire playboy philanthropist, as he once describes himself, is also very critical of him.
And it doesn't forget his past as an arms dealer.
It doesn't. And no, indeed. Everything has consequences. Mm. And his earlier irresponsibility about being an armaments manufacturer comes back to bite him hard in various of the films. And you can argue that in a way, as I have, that one of the reasons why Thanos works so well as a villain for these movies is that there's a sense in which he's Tony Stark's shadow double. Because he really thinks that he can solve the universe's problems with a single bold gesture.
Are we allowed to say what that gesture
no.
is?
No.
Well, it's the end of Infinity War.
I know.
Well, it seems like it's quite a striking, without saying it then, it's a very striking political thing to do, in a sense. It's mass destruction.
Yeah.
Yes.
I won't add any more detail to that. So, I mean, I suppose...
But the point about Thanos is that, at the end of the day, he is incapable of love.
Yep.
He thinks he loves his daughters. He tortures them for their own good.
Mm.
He thinks he's doing the right thing, yet somehow the only people he recruits as allies, aides, are utterly monstrous. And yet, that's the difference between him and Tony. Thanos has no friends, he only has minions.
Mm. I suppose that sort of brings me to what will probably have to be the final point then. You say in your piece that a big theme in the Avengers is family.
Mm.
And, you know, that can be family as in the domestic situation, but also between colleagues and friends. But in the family sphere, it's a very nuclear family that we're talking about here. In terms of the gender, the men are the men and the women are the women. And could things have been pushed a bit more here?
Well, the Guardians of the Galaxy, the raccoon's a raccoon and the tree's a tree.
That means nothing to me.
He's quite... I understand. He's quite a male raccoon and quite a male tree, I would argue.
Well, I mean, I don't think the tree ever gets
gendered.
Have I fallen asleep?
Sorry.
Do we need to be talking about equality rather than diversity? Because it's all very well to introduce characters from different backgrounds and of different genders, but they're still conforming.
Well, except, again, that's how the movies have been, because they've been playing it safe. If you look at the history of the Avengers as a team in the comic books, they've on occasion had more women than men. Certainly they've had female team leaders.
Right. But have they ever had gay couples?
No,
or...
not yet. Hardly, yeah. hardly
well, there
at
we go.
All.
That's one of the criticisms.
That's obviously one of the battles, because...
Maybe that's the next.
Well, you see, for a long time they were hindered in that respect by the Comics Code. You know that in the 1950s there was a congressional investigation of comics as part of an attempt to understand juvenile delinquency in the 50s. The congressional inquiry was visited by a psychiatrist called Frederick Wharton. And Frederick Wharton went along and said, this stuff is all terribly subversive, and apart from anything else, it promotes homosexuality, because look at Batman and Robin, and look at all these capes, and they all wear tights. And this actually had an effect of imposing on comics something rather like the Hays Code in the 30s on movies, which... Though the Comics Code only really lasted into the 70s, it colossally inhibited them from explicit stuff. Whereas, of course, in a sense, one of the consequences of that was that, one, that they did it all through coding, and two, an entire generation of queer, gender diverse kids grew up going, I know what's really going on. Even when it wasn't, because you will be aware that there is fan fiction about imaginary same-sex couplings between characters in popular culture. The ability to look at popular culture and consume it looking for possible relationships you can write about in fan fiction is called wearing slash goggles.
Do you know what? Everything now has started to make sense for me. And I think we're going to have to leave it there because otherwise a whole other dimension will be introduced.
We've got 80 years worth of comics to catch up on now.
Yeah. Ros Cabney, thank you so much for coming in.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
From the Marvel universe, we return to the more recognisable, if perhaps no less fraught ground of our own time and place. Many of the preoccupations carry over, in fact, Imogen Russell-Williams suggests in her roundup of some of the best fiction for children and young adults on an LGBTQ theme. There are questions about who has power and who does not, what responsibilities come with that power, how stories can be adapted for our times, what makes a good hero, and how best to represent and so empower those whose experience does not fit the existing template. In this context, Imogen points out the power belongs to those closest to children, either to shame them into harmful conformity or to welcome and celebrate their self-expression, so that, you might say, a perceived problem, an issue to be dealt with, might be recast as something of a special power to enjoy, to admire and to share in. Imogen Russell-Williams joins us in the studio now to talk us through some of the authors and books she recommends. Nice to have you with us, Imogen.
Lovely to be here.
You say it seems an appropriate time to discuss books that feature LGBTQ families and protagonists. Why is that?
Well, I mean, it's always an appropriate time, but particularly at the moment, I was struck by seeing parents protesting against inclusive sex education in Birmingham. And I think that that speaks to perhaps a misapprehension about what sort of education is actually going on. There's nothing age inappropriate. There's nothing explicit happening. It's just very straightforwardly a matter of saying some families have two mums, some families have two dads. And I think the more you can get that across in the picture books that kids are reading as well as maybe the books for 5 to 8 year olds, the beginning readers and independent readers, the less of an issue, in inverted commas, it becomes.
How then do these different books deal with, because there's a dual impulse then to sort of focus on and celebrate the exceptional aspect of the situation or sexuality, or at the same time as not making it this big deal.
Yes, there are, as you've pointed out, there are two ways of addressing the topic, I suppose. And in 5 to 8 books, I'd really like to see more of what we might call incidental representation, when you have families of a non-traditional makeup, but that's not the story. That's just in the background, and it doesn't really register with the kids in the story unless they're popping up and saying, "Oh, Dad and other Dad, can I go out for tea or whatever it is?" But one of the real beauties that I talk about in this piece is a picture book called Julian is a Mermaid. In its original form is Julian is a Mermaid. And that really foregrounds the idea of a little boy who loves mermaids and wants to dress up as a mermaid. And there's a moment at which his nana could... such a dramatic moment on the page. You think that his nana, when she finds him all togged up in flowers and a drapey curtain for a tail and with lipstick on, you really think that she's about to either let him have it or just storm out and leave him alone just to feel shame. But instead, she comes in and she brings him a necklace, and this completes his outfit, and then she takes him to join this mermaid parade. And it is honestly one of the most poignant and beautiful moments I think I've ever seen in a picture book.
It sounds it. I mean, even just listening to you recount it.
Yeah, and there's a beautiful picture of it as well that goes with your piece.
I like in that book there, Jessica Love, she describes how in making the book, she realised that if she changed the colour of the paper, it sort of quite literally seemed to change the whole tone of the work.
Yes, she's talked really interestingly about not understanding why it was flat, why it was feeling sort of barren. And she used the words white tundra, in fact, a really, really expressive, this sense of the Arctic remoteness of not at all the warmth that she was wanting to conjure. And then as soon as she began to work on brown paper, everything lifted and everything changed. And she's also talked about how that made her realise that we need to examine our defaults in everything, not just...
I think that happens in film, I think, doesn't it, as well? I think it depends what stock you use.
Yes.
And there are differences.
Well,
people look different in different sort of stocks.
Yeah.
And traditionally, the stock that's been used has been used to make basically...
White bodies look good.
White blonde people look good.
When Moonlight came out, I remember Barry Jenkins' film, everyone was talking about finally people are lighting black bodies to bring them alive. For
absolutely.
So this is kind of the paper equivalent of it.
Yes, absolutely. So I suppose, yes, you could say that it's an appropriate time to be lighting and celebrating all manner of marginalised characters, and this should happen on the page as well as elsewhere.
Mm. Another book, I think it's for the same age group that I really like the sound of is Alfred and Albert by Morag Hood, but I am partial to aardvarks, I must say. Sounds great.
I mean, anything that allows me to write the phrase star-crossed aardvarks.
What's not to love?
Exactly.
I hope they're not too star-crossed.
No, they're really not. They're not really aware that they're star-crossed. They're just a bit solitary. They're a bit lonely because they don't know about each other's existence. But there's this little blue bird who wants to play Cupid and is very frustrated by the fact that they are not meeting. And it's just the lovely thing about it is it's a very, very straightforward little story that could be about friendship or could be about love. But the protagonists are both boys. Mm. And she's taken a classic shape of a story. She's illustrated it with enormous wit and charm. She really is a cracking illustrator. I love her work. And then she's flipped the norm. She's just nudged it so that, and also the playfulness with the, because both Alfred and Albert have an extra A in the front of their names to fit with aardvark. And everything about that just delights me. I really think it's a barnstormer.
At the risk of showing my age, does anybody remember, and I don't know when exactly it's from, I tried to look it up, does anyone remember Frog and Duck?
Yes, absolutely. They've been going for quite a while.
They have still been going through. And they're a similar kind of thing, isn't it? If I remember right.
Yes, in a way, absolutely. There's a sense that love doesn't need to be two of the same.
Mm.
You don't need to look like the person who you fall in love with. Love just makes demands of you that you need to follow in order to live a rich and fulfilled life. And yes, I think that is on the same sort of scale and spectrum of acceptance of different kinds of love and relationships is a good thing.
Hmm.
Murder Most Unladylike by Robin Stephen came out in 2014, the first in a series set in the 1930s in a girls-only boarding school. How do we find things in Death in the Spotlight? How does she handle the historical element in the 1930s setting? It must be especially difficult, I would think, to not portray a relationship between two girls as illicit and wrong.
I've loved this series since Murder Most Unladylike first appeared, and I think it's partly that Robin manages to balance being saturated in her period, really, really, really having done her research and wearing it very lightly, but also making those little tweaks to amplify marginalised voices. So Hazel Wong, her narrator, is Hong Kong Chinese, and she's the first girl in her family to have come away to boarding school, and so naturally she is the butt of all manner of unthinking and deliberate racism, but this is handled very carefully and very well by Robin. And equally, in the first book we've got a teacher who, it transpires, was more than friends with another teacher and lived with this teacher. But it's not the sort of... It never becomes snigger fodder or anything like that. It's just... Hazel is a fabulous narrator for thoughtful processing and taking into her mind and understanding and making sense of, and in the process allowing the reader to do the same. So in the latest book, when Daisy, who is by far the most sort of forthright and confident aristocratic English character of the pairing, Wells and Wong, the two schoolgirl detectives, when Daisy discovers that she is attracted to an actress who's currently on their suspect list, Daisy is very worried that Hazel will reject her, and they're in a theatrical context, so they've sort of touched on the fact that one of the actors is gay and this is illegal, and he'll be endangered if people find out. But this seems stupid to the girls because they think he's not hurting anyone. What's the problem? But when Daisy explains her feelings to Hazel, and is so angry and defensive and spiky about the prospect that Hazel might reject her, and Hazel just responds with such calm acceptance, it's an absolutely wonderful moment. And I really think Robin she's done sterling work throughout the series, but that's one of my favourite moments of all of them.
It's present, because you say that in the books there is a bit, there's kind of talk about pashes and canoodling in the books of the time, or maybe a little bit later. There's in girls' boarding school books, there are girls who get crushes on other girls.
Yes,
anyway,
absolutely.
Aren't there? It's kind of a thing.
I think though that it's usually treated as a kind of training wheels for the real thing. That you sort of, you have your pash. It's something that you grow out of. Anyone who were to carry it on too long would really probably be sent to Coventry or looked at askance. There's not really the connection made between the kind, you know, the pash that might carry on too long, and then the two ladies who don't get married, who live in a cottage together. There's no continuum.
Right. There's no kind of grown-up way of moving through. There's no way of moving through from the pash there's no sort of path.
There's no pattern given,
Yeah. And in general, it's presumably, it's quite a rare thing to see sex treated explicitly in these books.
In books for 8 to 12 year olds, certainly, and in books for the younger end of YA teen, or there is a thing called clean teen, which indicates that there's no sex. there is a book in my piece called Jack of Hearts and Other Parts, which is extremely frank on the subject of sex. And I am frankly cheerleading for it and whooping for it, because there's a real sense of, oh goodness, well, teenagers, we mustn't really tell them about sex. But how wrong-headed is this?
Yeah.
When the first place that most teenagers are going to look for information about sex is online, and they will come across pornography. And this is a controlled, safe environment in which to encounter ideas about sex. So yeah, Jack of Hearts and Other Parts, which is by Lev Rosen, is very frank, because the main character part of the time is literally running a sex advice column. And so he talks about all sorts of things, about how you might approach having anal sex for the first time. And he demystifies so much stuff. Something that I've said in the piece is that it's like having a smart, savvy friend who's generous and willing enough to share all of their terrible experiences so that you don't have to go through it yourself. That seems to me just completely without parallel as a service to give to kids who don't know where else to find that sort of information. And it's really funny and witty and lively. It's a cracking read as well.
Mm. And also, you can tell your parents it's educational, because you say, "What, I'm reading? Leave me alone."
Well, and it will be a
they won't know.
It's true. Well, parents are very unlikely to pick up a YA book and go, "Oh, I hope this is suitable." So,
also, that brings me to my next question, I suppose. Who as readers get older, obviously, they're more likely to choose the reading for themselves. But certainly when we're talking about the younger readers, are these books relying on teachers and parents picking them up and giving them to someone who they perceive as being at some kind of juncture in their lives? Or
now, see, This is a very good question. I think that the less a book like this lives on the issues shelf, which is kind of, which calls so much attention to itself just by being a part. You could make the analogy that dyslexic kids would be less likely to go to the you know, the super readable or the easy reading shelf, even though they would probably enjoy those books very much, because there is an implicit stigma in the books that are set apart. If these books are just on the shelf with all the other YA, and if, well, in the best case scenario, you've got a brilliant, clued up librarian, either in school or in the kids section of the library, who knows enough about the individual kids to go, I think this might actually interest you, then that's what you really want to see.
Yeah, because it's, as you were saying, it's, well, it's like you were saying, Thea, there's sort of two ways of approaching it, but as you said, with the younger readers, that you just you have two dads in the background or something picking someone up from a play date, or two mums, and
it's just normalized.
And he says,
it's,
I didn't mean that, Mum, I meant the other one. But that's, as you said, that's not the focus. The only thing, the only parallel I can think of is in Frozen. Am I allowed to talk about Frozen?
Yes, definitely.
There's that moment, which I actually think is really important, when, I don't know if you know it, Thea.
No, I'm just,
it's
nodding politely.
It's a cracking film.
I'll burst into song at any moment.
And there's a bit when the it's the male lead, isn't it? The protagonist goes into a sauna. They're in the middle of it. It's all very frozen. It's all very, very snowy, very, very cold. Oh, no, maybe it's the princess. Can't remember. One of them goes into a sauna. I think it's the princess. And she's completely unkitted out for the cold, so she has to try and buy some stuff. And so there's a funny bit with the shop owner who tries to sell her things that are out of season and all of that. And at one point they're having a nice chat and he says, oh, wave hello to my family who's in the sauna, because it's all, they're in, where do they live? Somewhere Scandinavian. It's
Norway,
not very,
I think.
Is it actually Norway?
Yeah.
Wave to my family who's in the sauna. And in the sauna is another dad and a couple of kids, I think. Is that right?
I think you're right.
Are.
Yeah.
And she just goes, oh, hello, Sven. And then they carry on. And then the film goes on its way. But what you've seen, in fact, is a family with a couple of dads.
Mm.
Perfectly normal. In the background. Nothing to see here. Let's go and make a snowman.
Exactly. And also that film obviously is remarkable for being, I think, the first Disney film that doesn't need to end in marriage, and in which true love is the love between sisters, and the sisters save themselves. So, yeah, no, there was no Frozen bashing here.
It's interesting that sort of loops back to what we were talking about earlier on the when we were talking about Marvel and the kind of the move away from nuclear families, and when would it happen? It sounds like it already sort of has a little bit.
Well, a
in
bit,
the Disney
and
world.
Frozen, and I know that everybody kind of jokes about the song, but also people loved Let It Go because she's expressing her true inner nature for the first time, and she feels much better.
It's hugely,
I mean, I know
subversive.
It sounds
your eyebrows.
There's a reason why little kids love it so much. I mean, obviously, predominantly it's girls, but little boys belt it out as well.
They do, yeah.
And there's a reason for that, because I mean the idea of breaking the rules and letting go finally resonates with most children, because most children want more agency than they get, but the idea of being your authentic self when you have literally had to wear gloves and be kind of buttoned into yourself for your whole life long, it's hugely liberating. Also, I think it's a good song, but
Finally, this would not be the TLS podcast if I did not ask you to tell us about the Pride and Prejudice reworking that appears in one of these books.
It really is. It's splendid. So it's by Karen Lawler, who I hope is working on a full-length novel, because I really did enjoy this story. I felt it was witty and light-hearted, it was just everything you want in a short story, but obviously it was also erudite because it was reworking Pride and Prejudice, and it had two girls as the protagonists. And something about the high school setting, and it begins with at a dance, and Lizzie overhears Darcy basically bitching about her to a friend at the sinks, and there's just this moment where she sort of goes, fine, guess I'm not peeing, and comes out to challenge them. And I love it. I love everything about it. I think it's really, really fab. That whole anthology, though, that's from the anthology Proud, which is published by Stripes and edited by Juno Dawson. There's going to be something in it that will resonate and speak to anyone who is in need of this amazing book with a rainbow clenched fist on the cover. It's lovely.
It sounds it. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all we have time for this week. Our thanks
Sorry, I was just going to say, unless anybody wants to sing anything from Frozen. No, that's fine.
I mean, be my guest. That is all we have time for. Our thanks to Imogen, Russell Williams and Roz Caveney. Don't forget about the subscription offer mentioned at the start of this episode, as well as the pieces we've discussed here. This week's issue also covers the story of L.E.L., the woman the Victorians wanted to forget but who haunted them. The origins of the infamous Myers-Briggs personality test, what dementia teaches us, the traumatic history of Notre Dame and Second World War sabotage, among a great deal else. Next week, we'll be looking at the middle years of T.S. Eliot, racism in Disney's Dumbo and Sudan's uprising. For now, though, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.